Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
What can Brown do for Democrats? Put them on the ropes.
We're not going to rush into anything. We're going to wait until the new senator arrives before we do anything more on health care.
Democrats in the Senate move into triage mode.
I would advise that we try to move quickly to coalesce around those elements of the package that people agree on.
But can this patient be saved? Or is it time for the last rites for health care legislation? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning to you. Thursday, January 21st. I'm Miles O'Brien, in all week for Celeste Headlee on vacation. I guess the takeaway this morning, John, is democracy is messy.
Yes, and you spelled the rights wrong. It's R-I-T. You do have an
R-I-T-H-T-S. This is radio. I don't have to spell in radio.
Get to the top stories. You know your medium there, Miles O'Brien. Let's get to the top stories we're following this morning. President Obama, as Miles mentioned, is blaming the Democrats' stunning loss of their filibuster-proof Senate majority on his failure to connect to the economic frustrations of the middle class. When it comes to passing the health care bill, he told ABC News last night,
"The Senate certainly shouldn't try to jam anything through until Scott Brown is seated. People in Massachusetts spoke. He's got to be part of that process."
Who speaks now? What do congressional Democrats think about that? We're joined by Representative Anthony Weiner from New York. Congressman, first of all, good morning and thanks for being a part of the program.
Good morning.
Are you happy that suddenly the House takes center stage here?
Well, no, it's hard to be happy as someone who's a supporter of strong health care reforms and a supporter of President Obama. We've got a mess because we've got three groups, Republicans who won't want to do anything ever, independents who seem confused by the whole process, and people like me who feel that a lot of our values have been compromised in this process. So you said it right. It's kind of a mess right now.
Although wouldn't the framers say, get together, guys, compromise?
Well, that's exactly right. But, you know, part of what needs to happen now is I think we need the president, and he acknowledged this yesterday, needs to strongly lead and lean into this problem, this notion of worshiping at the altar of 60 votes has complicated and confused our message.
Well, we're going to talk about that altar of 60 votes with the Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner. Stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
The Pentagon is ordering another 2,000 Marines to Haiti, which will push the number of U.S. troops in and around the island to 16,000 by the weekend. The Takeaway spoke with the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen yesterday, John did that, about the military's main focus in Haiti at this time.
But our main effort, our main focus, main goal is to provide this relief and provide security for the relief effort.
You can see the entire interview at our website, thetakeaway.org. As the logistics of the relief effort improves, search and rescue teams are still pulling survivors out of the rubble. This Danish UN peacekeeper spent 5 days buried beneath concrete. He said the only way he made it was with
a belief in that I would survive, that I would be found. I think mentally made me survive.
President Obama and the First Lady are joining Americans in making donations to help the victims in Haiti. They're donating $15,000 from their personal bank account to the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund.
A couple of other quick stories. The president expected to announce a plan to give the government new powers to limit the size of the nation's largest banks, as well as to stop them from trading on their own accounts. Senate Democrats want the federal government to borrow another $2 trillion to pay its bills. If that request is granted, it would push the national deficit to $14.3 trillion. And China, boy, there are happy headlines over there. Its boom continues. That economy grew at 10.7% in the last quarter of 2009. Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,603. The S&P opens at 1,138 and the NASDAQ at 2,291. Miles?
Coming up in the program, you've probably seen war coverage in print, on TV, and in photos. But what about in comics? We'll talk with graphic novelist and journalist Joe Sacco about the violence in Gaza later this hour.
What do you guys think about it?
If you didn't have the 60-vote supermajority rule, many issues would go back and forth every time the majority in Congress changed, and it'd be chaos.
We're going to talk about that 60-vote rule with Anthony Weiner. Stay with us. A Good morning, everyone. As I was pulling out of Washington, D.C. yesterday on Capitol Hill, there was all kinds of reaction to the election result on Tuesday night in Massachusetts, electing a Republican senator, Scott Brown, for the first time in 50 years. Listen to Senator John McCain on the Senate floor yesterday.
Last night, a shot was fired around this nation. A shot was fired saying, no more business as usual in Washington, D.C. Stop this unsavory sausage-making process called health care reform.
So, question there, Senator McCain raises it. What is business as usual in Washington, D.C.? And is this about health care reform or something broader, something bigger, something possibly even constitutional in nature?
Or sausage.
or what is the sausage, exactly? Sausage is tasty. It's not good to look at, right? Isn't
exactly
that the word?
That's
Representative
it.
Anthony Weiner is still with us. He's on the phone from his home in Washington. Thanks for being with us, Representative.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And also, we are privileged to have Julian Zelizer, a congressional historian at Princeton University. He's the author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Julian Zelizer, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
So, Professor Zelizer, Anthony Weiner said at the top of the hour that he's sick and tired or something, I think I'm characterizing it correctly, of worshiping at the altar of the 60-vote rule in the Senate. Does he have a point there, and when did this altar get built?
Well, I think it's one of the greatest sources of frustration. Now we expect 60 votes on almost every piece of legislation in the Senate. It's a product of the last two or three decades, really, as the filibuster gradually became a normalized tool of combat in American politics. It wasn't this way before the 1970s. And so now we have a supermajority Senate where that 60 is always required.
And now it's less than 60, and so the Senate is not going to be able to pass its own bill or pass a conference bill. What is the impact of the 60-vote rule on your business in the House of Representatives, Democratic Representative Anthony Weiner?
Well, I'll give your listeners some perspective on this. If we didn't have 60 votes, if we simply had majority rule, which we're all taught about in elementary school in this country, we'd probably have a public option. We'd probably have an expanded Medicare with a longer life expectancy for the program. We'd probably have the donut hole for prescription drugs that would be closed so seniors wouldn't be without coverage. And we'd probably have things like, you know, young people when they get out of college being covered under their parents' plan. You know, a lot of the things that are very popular that people in Massachusetts and around the country would probably say we really want passed would probably not only have been passed, but would have been passed with great fanfare, and the American people would have been, instead of disenfranchised and disenchanted, would have been very happy. So this 60-vote rule is really what is giving us the logjam that so many people are decrying, including John McCain in your last bite.
Now, you mentioned learn about majority rule in elementary school, and I did, and I think a lot of people do. Do we have a strange sort of culture of bipartisanship or talking about it in the United States? I mean, majority rules, party line votes, that's a sign of the function of the system. But we're taught to believe by people in the media and elsewhere that, in fact, that's a sign of dysfunction, that if you don't have bipartisanship, there's something wrong. Anthony Weiner?
Well, you're exactly right. You know, we all talk about the desire for bipartisanship, but what the American people really want is us to get stuff done. And frankly, the frustration that we have in our recent congressional history and political history is people decry bipartisanship and gridlock, the lack of bipartisanship and gridlock at the same time. What they really want is for us to get things done that they like. When you scrape away everything else, that's what they want. And frankly, the procedural machinations in the Senate have created this environment of inertia that I think really is what the American people want us to get past.
So, Julian Zelizer, is there some historical precedent or is the historical milestone that people like you are going to write about, you know, years from now, that this is the first time a president sort of bet an entire program on the 60-vote rule and got his head handed to him?
Well, I think a lot of presidents have bet on one big piece of legislation. But, you know, usually you hope that you come out of it with something. So we had compared him to Lyndon Johnson, who betted on really a 67-vote bill, which was civil rights. But he pushed and shoved and cajoled, and he got Republicans to come over to his side, but not through nice politics, through hardball politics. And he got the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, and his story turned out much differently, at least on domestic domestic policy. The problem here is, I think he hoped for bipartisanship with a party that wasn't going to give a single vote, and I don't think he was willing to use the hammer, so to speak, to get some of those votes one way or another. So I do think it's a kind of stark contrast so far with Lyndon Johnson, that civil rights bill, and the rest of the Great Society.
Great context there. So is this an argument for harder ball politics on the part of the president, or is it an argument for changing the rule? That rule eventually went from 67 to 60, right?
It does, but not till 1975. And so he gets it with the existing structure. Look, one path is filibuster reform, but that's going to be extraordinarily difficult to achieve. So lowering the number of senators required from 60 to even lower, 55, 50. The other is using things like reconciliation, the budget process that allows you to avoid a filibuster. And finally, the other is to use presidential power to do what, you know, Speaker Pelosi does in the House and other speakers have done, to really lean on all members of the Democratic Party and force their hand to vote for this bill and do a little bit of that with Republicans.
And that's what whips do in the House of Representatives. Here's the Republican whip, Eric Cantor, giving his reaction to the Massachusetts result yesterday in Washington.
I look back a few months ago when I met with Majority Leader Hoyer, and I would guess this morning that perhaps he's thinking maybe he should have paid a bit more attention, because in that meeting I put forth our Republican plan to effect health care reform to bring down costs. There is a way for us to work together.
Democratic Representative Anthony Weiner of New York, is there a way for you to work together with Eric Cantor and the Republicans in the House?
Eric Cantor and his party has made it very clear that they are not going to participate in anything that will give President Obama any success. They've been the most partisan of hacks in this process. That's not a procedural problem. That's a strategic problem that the Republicans have made the determination. They don't want the president to have any success, and so that's the posture they've taken. That's fine, but I think the president needs to lean into this thing, travel around the country, talk about the popular elements of this plan, and lead by the way we only get big bills in this country is by muscular presidential leadership.
Muscular presidential leadership. Well, we will watch for that. Representative Anthony Weiner, Democrat of New York, thanks so much for that discussion, along with Julian Zelizer, congressional historian at Princeton University, author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security. Thanks to both of you. So at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on the headlines we're following. Miles?
The president says the Senate should not try to push through health reform until Massachusetts Senator-elect Scott Brown takes up his seat in Washington. Meanwhile, as negotiations continue, Democratic Congressman Bart Stupak says there's no support in the House for the health care bill that was approved by the Senate.
If you ran that Senate bill right now on the House floor, I'll bet you would not get 100 votes for it.
Moving to Haiti, the president says the U.S. effort is stepping up in Haiti.
I want to make sure that when America projects its power around the world, it's not seen only when it's fighting a war.
Meanwhile, U.S. and other rescue teams say they are still looking for buried survivors. The International Medical Corps found a five-year-old child alive in the ruins just yesterday. Here's some big news breaking. Former Senator John Edwards admits now he's the father of a baby born to a woman he saw outside his marriage. Well, he did more than see her, apparently. We'll bring you more as we have it. Economic news globally. The Chinese economy has beaten all expectations and grown by a massive 8.7% last year. Economists expect China will eventually, and maybe pretty quickly, overtake Japan as the world's second largest economy. The New York Times plans to charge readers for full access to its website next year. Under the plan, the Times will use a metered system that allows readers to read a certain number of stories for free each month. The Takeaway website is free, though.
Continue. And remaining so.
Yes, indeed, remaining so. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Miles, what's coming up?
Coming up today, President Obama will propose giving bank regulators the power to limit the size of the nation's banks. Luis Story is here.
Hey, you want that to go?
It's time to take out some cash, so to speak. And for those who wonder where the regulators and the regulations were when the economy tanked, there's a new plan in the works. The president will unveil it at 11:45 a.m. Eastern Time. The idea is to give the government more control over the banks. That's the idea, anyhow. Louise Story is back, quick as the Acela, finance reporter for the New York Times. Good to have you with us again, Louise. Tell us about this proposal. What do we know about it?
So we only know a few details, Miles, but we know it's focused on the size of the banks and the amount of risk they take. And, of course, this is the biggest criticism from the crisis, that these banks not only got so big that we had to save them because they were too big, but also that they were taking too many risks. They were trading for their own books. They were investing in mortgages, when what they're supposed to be doing is taking your money, holding it safely as deposits, and doing the instrumental kind of pipeline banking of the country.
Oh, what a quaint notion you have there.
What a quaint notion. But, you know, that's what, in the Depression, when we had, you know, a similar crisis, there were these laws created known as Glass-Steagall that split up the banking, the traditional pipeline banking of this country, from the trading. And that was all repealed in the late 90s so that banks could do both. And that's one of the things that some people think got us into this crisis. So today, with this announcement, we'll all be listening for how much will this take us back to a separation between regular banking and trading. You know, and
well, maybe we should listen to the lessons of history here. Who's been pushing this?
Well, the interesting thing is that Paul Volcker, you know, who is a former chairman of the Fed, has been pushing and pushing publicly since the fall that you should really rein in the prop trading at these banks. It's the prop trading that leads to
prop trading, meaning
proprietary trading, okay, trading for your own book. And that's what leads to a lot of the big bonuses and payday on Wall Street that you're seeing now. Excuse me. And so it's very interesting. He's been pushing for it. Obama hasn't been listening. I think this could be a major shift in the Obama administration. Remember, they put out a full...
Well, it's a shift in... I mean, Larry Summers was part of the crew that deregulated
That's
everything.
Right. Larry Summers, a top economic advisor, deregulated this in the Clinton years. And I would have loved to have been on this conversation with Obama and Volcker recently, where Obama says to Volcker, I know you've been pushing for this all year. I know you've been pushing. I didn't do it last summer when I proposed financial reform, but okay, Volcker, you're right. Let's do it. Let's rein in these banks.
Elizabeth Warren has specifically endorsed that proposal
on this
program. That's true.
All right.
The oversight person on the TARP. All right, thanks, Louise. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our takeaway sports contributor, is watching the football this weekend. And, you know, everyone loves, all of a sudden, the New York Jets.
We thought we had a great chance, you know, to make it to the playoffs, but Atlanta found a way to win.
That's Coach Rex Ryan, who thinks the Jets are the team to beat. He's actually saying the goal of the Jets is one thing.
Collectively, our team has one goal, one focus, and that's to try to win the Super Bowl.
So Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports contributor, you've got Rex Ryan with a sad face there in that first cut, and Rex Ryan with a very happy face, and some would say a kind of delusional face looking forward to the Super Bowl.
That's funny, a delusional face. The entire playoff run that the Jets have made could seem potentially delusional and dreamy, and that's exactly what the Jets need to do. That's one of the things that they
the
need
Colts
to beat the
weekend,
Colts.
Yeah.
They need to be a little bit in the clouds. And I'll tell you, they need to do three or four things that will guarantee them a win. Number one, they need to score over 20 points. If they don't score over 20 points, the Indianapolis Colts will surely score over 20 points, and they'll stop them quickly. The other thing is that the Jets quarterback Mark Sanchez has thrown interceptions this year at critical moments. They need to stop that. That cannot happen. He threw one interception last game, but in the past 4 or 5 weeks, he's been very excellent, actually, in that arena. And part of it is because they don't make him throw in very tense situations. They run the ball so much. So there's two other things. The Indianapolis defense is a porous run defense. Their main people are pass rushers, and they come from the outside, like Dwight Freeney, who I told you earlier in the season
was a key
to the Colts getting this far. Now, they're not great on the run defense, and that's where the Jets have a strength. Their offensive line is going to push them off the ground, and that will be a strong – Sean Green is going to be excellent for them. The other piece
– Are you saying the Jets are favored? That's not what they say in Las Vegas.
In football terms, in football language, the Jets have a really – the matchups are really excellent. And the other matchup that's good is that the Colts' wide receiver core is not as good as the Chargers, who the Jets beat last week.
All right.
They're a bunch of rookies, and the Jets have amazing cornerbacks and defensive backs. They have a strength in their defense and in their running game, and they can beat the Colts this weekend.
All right, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
You know, it's a rematch of Super Bowl III.
That is true.
Joe Namath should be out there doing the coin toss.
That's interesting. Good call. Yeah. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, takeaway sports contributor, talking about Jets versus Colts this weekend, also the Vikings versus the Saints in the other big game. Our last takeout comes from our listeners, right?
Yes.
This is Sam calling from Philadelphia. I'm very frustrated with the way things are happening. And with the health care bill, it looks like the politicians are more interested in making a name for themselves than they are in what's good for the country.
We've been hearing what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE and by email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Was it really a referendum on health care, on politics in Washington, maybe?
I'm an independent, and I'm calling to say that I think the reaction that we're seeing around the country against Democrats has to do in large part with the fact that health care is being treated far too politically. It's just too important to be rammed through without agreement on both sides.
Like most people around the world, I am just shocked that Americans are so opposed to health care reform. I think what Americans have is called the Stockholm Syndrome. In this case, the American people are the hostages, and the hostage takers are the large pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies.
Do you feel like a hostage? What's the message from Massachusetts? Lewis emailed us. They should keep the 60-vote rule in the Senate, he writes us, but the filibuster rule should go back to speaking for 24 hours. Congress makes everything too easy for themselves. Today we're asking you about the loss of the Democrats' filibuster-proof majority. Does having less than 60 votes mean that Congress can't pass health care? Should the rule change? You know how to reach us. 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, we'll give you an idea of how hard it is medically treating people in Haiti. That's in just a few moments. But here are some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. President Obama tells ABC News about the lessons he learned this week.
Here's my assessment of not just the vote in Massachusetts, but the mood around the country. You know, the same thing that swept Scott Brown into office swept me into office. People are angry and they're frustrated.
And when it comes to passing the health care bill,
the Senate certainly shouldn't try to jam anything through until Scott Brown is seated. People in Massachusetts spoke. He's got to be part of that process.
Democrats are signaling they'll scale back the bill.
The president, meanwhile, is ordering more U.S. troops into Haiti. Right now, some 11,000 soldiers are in and around Haiti, with another 2,000 Marines heading to the earthquake zone soon. In the bay surrounding Port-au-Prince, the USNS Comfort, the hospital ship, is treating some of the worst-off patients. The naval surgeon on board is impressed with how long many badly injured Haitians were able to survive.
The fact that they've made it, you know, 7 days out, 8 days out with these injuries and they're still here just speaks, you know, worlds towards how resilient, you know, they are.
Our partners, the BBC, have been talking with medical workers on the ground in Haiti, describing the difficulties of the treatment. We're going to continue that conversation in just a moment. But yesterday at the Pentagon, I asked Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen about the military's role in Haiti.
We've worked with the Haitian leadership from the beginning. I mean, we are there in support of the Haitian leadership, overall, the UN in terms of the relief efforts, and in particular, the UN security forces supporting them from a security standpoint. But our main effort, our main focus, main goal is to provide this relief and provide security for the relief effort.
You can see portions of my interview with Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen on our website, thetakeaway.org. In another move to help Haiti recover, there are reports the banks may reopen this weekend, which would help the flow of money from Haitians overseas sending their remittances. And if you read the New York Times online, you may have to start paying for the pleasure. The Times will reportedly use a metered system, which allows readers to click on a certain number of stories for free before fees kick in. No word on how much those fees would be or exactly when this would start. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures are down. The Dow will get underway negatively, it looks like, at 10,603. The S&P opens at 1,138, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,291. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The good ship Comfort has steamed into a sea of misery in Haiti. The huge floating hospital has 1,000 beds, a big number to be sure, but not compared to the need in Haiti. The worry this morning in that island nation, besides the prospect of more aftershocks, is will injured people who could otherwise survive die for lack of basic medical care? Our partner, the BBC, is there, witness to trauma care in frighteningly primitive conditions.
People are lying on wooden pallets, usually used for stacking goods up instead of beds. They've obviously run out of beds here. There are patients with very severe trauma injuries to the head, broken hands, broken legs. They are being treated by the doctors here, but the operating table is literally a wooden table with some clean paper, surgical paper put over it and stuck down with sellotape.
With us now is Dr. Arthur Fournier. He is the Associate Dean for Community Health Affairs at the University of Miami Leonard Miller School of Medicine. He just returned from Haiti. Dr. Fournier, welcome to the program. From your visit in Haiti, what is the current status, as best we can tell, of medical care there?
Well, the current status is chaotic, but it's much less chaotic than it was a week ago. We ourselves, the Miller School of Medicine, have been engaged in Haiti for 15 years, and I think the connections we've made at all levels of society have allowed us to perhaps be a little less chaotic and a little bit more organized than perhaps other people of goodwill who haven't been engaged in Haiti. Today we are opening a full-fledged field hospital and we'll be evacuating our patients from the UN compound triage hospital where we first started the day after the earthquake.
What are the pressing needs right now? Early on, of course, supplies were a big problem. Has that problem been solved?
It's been pretty much solved for us, but not for everyone. We have a close bond between people of goodwill at all levels of society in Miami and our Haitian American community and a deep love for Haiti. So our outpouring of equipment and supplies and the Miller School of Medicine's commitment to this relief effort has been extraordinary. And we were fortunate enough to have several families in Miami donate their private aircraft. And we've been sending three flights a day on the average since the day after the quake. And so we have good supplies of antibiotics, surgical supplies. We've been carrying on amputations. We're treating the infections that we see so commonly with this. We're resuscitating people from shock. And we're in pretty good shape. We are fortunate enough that the government gave us a plot of land right next to the airport to set up our field tents. And so our particular case, we're pretty good. Well, I can't really speak for others,
Doctor,
but we're doing okay.
Doctor, react to this. We've been hearing these voices all morning. Let me just give you some quotes. Here's an aid worker saying, "I'm trying to make a decision whether we keep this patient alive or not. Some doctors here say we have to let him go, but I don't want to give up on him." And another aid worker who we heard this morning, "It's harder when they come in conscious, begging you to save them, and there's nothing we can do." How do you respond to situations like that?
I think we just have to do the best we can under the circumstances we find ourselves in. In the very beginning, we were doing operations on kitchen tables, outdoors, because there was no light in the tent. Things have gradually improved, and just with every improvement, you try and save more lives and do more. We resuscitated a little girl, 6 weeks old, who was on death's doorstep with basically an IV and some fluids and some D50, and we were fortunate enough to have a plane on the runway ready to go back to Miami, so we evacuated her to Jackson Memorial Hospital here in Miami, and she's in perfect shape today.
Wow.
So you just do the best you can with the conditions on the ground.
Do what you can. Tell us about how things are going to evolve medically. We go from trauma into other concerns, disease, dysentery, cholera, that kind of thing.
We have knowledge on this. This crisis will evolve from trauma, fractures, crush injuries. We will see kidney failure as a result of many of the crush injuries. I don't need to go into the mechanism of that, but it's predictable. Then we're going to see a wave of infectious diseases. One that people haven't really talked a lot about, but we're going to see soon, is tetanus, which is an easy disease to prevent, but a horrible disease to treat. And then we're going to see diarrhea, dysentery, and pneumonia. Are predictable. We may see outbreaks of hepatitis and other foodborne diseases.
All right, and just briefly, what's being done to stem all of that?
I'm sorry, it was difficult to hearing you.
What's being done to stem that the spread of disease?
Well, again, we're being proactive. We're flying in tetanus immune globulin today. We've got penicillin to treat tetanus. We've got surgeons to debride the wounds. We've got oral rehydration therapy, which you need to treat the diarrhea. I think people just have to think out of the box. For those of people of goodwill who've not worked in global health settings before, they need to consult with people who have.
Dr. Fournier?
The biggest missing link right now is that there's nobody really organizing all the various people of goodwill and giving them a specific assignment.
Dr. Arthur M. Fournier with the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Thanks for your time.
It's all about coordination. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry here with Miles O'Brien. And you know, Miles, we talk about the death toll and the losses in Haiti in raw numbers like 50,000 or 200,000. Again, the death toll has not been nailed down there in Haiti. But we've invited someone to come on the program to talk about losses that are smaller in number but probably bigger in scale, both personally and for the impact that these individuals who were lost in the earthquake apparently had on people in Haiti. Carol Charles joins us, sociology professor at Baruch College in New York. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
Describe the loss of three individuals who you knew very, very well and the work that they did in Haiti.
Yeah. I don't think we can wait. We can assess the impact of these women on people's life, and particularly on women and girls. My relationship with three of them, particularly with Miriam, date back to almost 40 years. And when we start working within the diaspora, particularly in Canada, organizing women, and we prepared Nairobi 85 together. She was in my house she spent the night in my house on her way to Montreal.
And her name was Miriam Merlet.
Uh-huh. And on December 21st, in fact, just an anecdote, I'm still drinking the coffee that she bought me from Haiti.
Oh.
And so my relationship with her in particular and with these other women, Magali and
Marceline, right?
Right, Magali Marceline and Marie-Claude Yolande was very complex, both personally, intertwining my personal relationship, my militancy and my political view about change in Haiti. I mean, we share those things, and sisterhood in addition. So as I said to you know, in a note, it's really a large part of my life that is gone.
Wow. And these women, their career, their mission was to really open Haiti politically by empowering women and children.
Exactly. And it was one of the key things that they were always promoting is that we have to do politics differently. And part of doing politics differently, that was their slogan, was to bring women at the center of the decision-making and make women real citizens. Miriam organized a whole Caribbean in 2007, I think, a whole conference on citizenship in the region, one of the first ones in the region, and centering on women and access to citizenship, and really getting moving away from a for a type of citizenship that was second-class citizenship. So their vision was not only short-term struggle and gains, but also a larger view of what.
Well, in this moment where Americans are giving $300 million for Haitian relief, perhaps it's also something we should be reminded of, the legacy of these three women, Magali Marceline, Marie Coriolan, and Miriam Merlet, getting women more into the center of the political rebuilding of Haiti. Thank you so much for that remembrance. Carol Charles is a sociology professor at Baruch College. She lost three of her friends in the Haitian earthquake. I'm John Huckleberry here with Miles O'Brien. Good morning. And coming up, we're going to descend into Gaza looking for hope and political clarity and we're going to be accompanied by graphic novelist Joe Sacco. His new book, Footnotes in Gaza, is the focus of our discussion. We're going to talk in just a few moments, but right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has been commenting on the Republican win in Massachusetts on Tuesday. The Senate leader is heavily involved in the president's health care reform efforts.
We're not going to rush into anything. We're going to wait until the new senator arrives before we do anything more on health care.
That new senator-elect from Massachusetts, Scott Brown, is touching base with his new colleagues today in Washington. He'll meet with Senator John McCain and his new partner, senior senator from Massachusetts, John Kerry. And from a new senator to an old one, in the past hour we've learned that former Senator John Edwards has admitted he's the father of a baby born to a woman he had an affair with outside his marriage. That's just out this morning.
Moving now to Haiti, yesterday's aftershock caused even more damage and traumatized already desperate survivors. Now rescue vessels led by the U.S. hospital ship Comfort have converged on the Port-au-Prince harbor. One of the ship's surgeons, Tim Donahue, explained the scene on board.
I've got five operating rooms running right now on patients that are getting, you know, washouts, amputations, and revisions of their amputations. So it's picking up at a good clip.
In another move to help Haiti recover, there are reports some banks will reopen this weekend, which would help the flow of money from Haitians overseas. Finally, moving to Asia, China says its economy is recovered, and that's in capitals. That's in large part in thanks to a massive government stimulus package. Their economy beat expectations and grew 8.7% last year. Economists expect China's economy to overtake Japan's as the world's second largest economy soon, if it hasn't done so already.
Are Chinese characters in capitals? I think they're it's just like one character.
Unless you're doing the pinyin.
Yeah, but right.
Then you can, that's another right. There we go. Those are some of the news stories we're watching for you this morning in English.
So when I was a foreign correspondent based in Jerusalem, I used to spend a lot of time in a place that spends a lot of time in the headlines around the world, Gaza. That territory, a little strip of land sometimes called the Gaza Strip. If you work in Gaza, if you go to Gaza, you descend into a place like no other. One of the densest places in the world, certainly one of the least politically stable places in the world, and an archive, in a sense, of history of the Palestinians and of the uneasy relationship that Israel has with its neighbors. If you can't go to Gaza yourself, you can appreciate and experience some of this descent by reading a new book called Footnotes in Gaza. It's Joe Sacco's new book. It's a graphic novel. It's based on two moments in Palestinian history that we're going to talk about in a moment, but visually, it is that descent into Gaza. The characters you meet are eerily like the real people that I spent time with back in the 80s. Joe Sacco, author of Footnotes in Gaza, is here in the studio with me. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Good to be here.
You know, it is amazing how much of a descent into the real Gaza that I remember this book is. But let's begin by talking about the historical underpinnings of this story that you tell in Footnotes in Gaza.
Okay. Palestinian refugees came to Gaza, and they started going back. There was a guerrilla war with Israel, and at some point in 1956, Israel, Britain, and France attacked Egypt. And Israel conquered the Gaza Strip at that, which was controlled by the Egyptians, and went into a couple of towns. And the UN, according to the UN, there were large numbers of civilian casualties.
And the story of this book is a character who looks remarkably like you, although not flatteringly so, going around and trying to find the truth of the matter. Is this journalism? And I guess you don't need to carry a microphone if you're a cartoonist in Gaza, right?
I think it is journalism, and I did carry a microphone.
Really?
I mean, I did interview people mm-hmm. and taped conversations and all that sort of thing.
And did they know you were a cartoonist, or did they think you were just a journalist?
Well, I introduced myself as someone who was going to do their story in comics, and I showed my previous work about the Palestinians to them.
And your book, Palestine, which won awards, and your book about Garajda, a particularly brutal event in the Bosnian conflict, right?
Right. I showed them the book Palestine, and they would open it up and sort of see what I was trying to do. They could see themselves in a way in the drawings.
And your drawings are realistic, But I think the journey that you're on here reminds me a little bit, and there may be some listeners that go crazy when I say this, but of the work of Art Spiegelman, whose sort of Holocaust work, very stylized, is another attempt to use cartoons to get into a place that maybe feels more true, more raw than the journalism that we see.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm kind of a comrade of Art Spiegelman. That's how I think of myself. We're friends. I think there's a lot you can do with the drawings that you can't do with regular sorts of journalism. I think you can really take a person to a place and to a time. Just like he does, I can take someone back into time also.
And, you know, looking at some of the pictures in here and seeing you against the wall drinking tea and eating chicken and rice and smoking cigarettes endlessly, the smells, the whole experience comes back completely. Are you striving for realism, or do you want people to get a larger point here?
Well, I am striving for realism. I do want people to get a sense of what it feels like there. I want people to feel the taste in the mouth that I had when I was there and sort of feel the dust swirling around their feet in the same way.
But you don't necessarily want them to have much sympathy for the Israelis here. I mean, Gaza is a place that doesn't have many points of view, it seems. There's a lot of factions within Gaza, but as far as the Israelis are concerned, this is one side of a story.
It is one side of a story. I'm telling mostly from the Palestinian point of view, though not entirely. But I don't sugarcoat Palestinians either. I mean, I'm trying to show Palestinians honestly.
Did you enjoy being in Gaza?
I love being in Gaza.
Really?
I like the place. I like the people. I know I can say that out of a sense that there's a luxury that I can get out. But the people are very hospitable. And it's always sort of a privilege to be invited into their homes and hear their stories.
And, you know, it seems to me, and I'm familiar with your work, that Gaza is kind of a place that goes with your personality, a sort of a sitting on the fringes kind of guy, maybe soft-spoken, doesn't render his opinions. And when he does, maybe they're a little dark. Did you find anything about Gaza, aside from the story, that was particularly compelling to you?
Aside from the story, I think it's just the way people treated me, mm-hmm. the hospitality. Talking about other things also, the black humor.
You know, people talk, we talk on this program a lot, and I'm sure you hear this a lot, that, you know, the media is changing. Forms of journalism are changing. Styles of journalism are changing. We talk a lot about Twitter. Twitter was the first indication of what happened in Haiti, for instance. There's right. a lot of discussion of Twitter in the Iranian Revolution, a place where I can see you easily going to maybe do your next book. But should we also include these forms as well? Many fewer people are writing comics about Gaza than are Twittering, but nevertheless.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, I think the form is here to stay, and I think other people are going to try using the form to do journalism.
And does it matter whether you render your images realistically or, as Spiegelman does, as animal characters?
Well, the interesting thing about doing it in cartoon forms is there are a lot of ways to do it. I mean, Spiegelman anthropomorphized figures, and I'm drawing realistically, but I think mm-hmm. both ways work.
Although I think you don't draw yourself realistically. You are the ugliest character in your own books.
And in reality, I'm a good-looking guy.
We will let you go to our website and determine if that is indeed the case. Joe Sacco is the author of Footnotes in Gaza. It is a descent into a place like no other on Earth. Joe Sacco, thanks so much for being
Thank
here.
Thank you very much for having me.
And indeed, if you want to see what that comic book looks like, we have a slideshow for you. It's at our website, thetakeaway.org.
And while you're there, you can sign up for our podcast to catch up on anything you missed or want to re-listen to. One thing you'll definitely want to re-listen to is our interview with Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen. You know, I wish, Joe Sacco, you were with me yesterday at the Pentagon. You could have done a good rendering of him for our website. We have a bonus video for you. Why would Mike Mullen be on Twitter?
To try to be in touch with those a lot younger than I, because they make up the vast majority of the 2.2 million men and women who serve.
Why does the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Twitter? Go to our website to find out. Hint, Mrs. Mullen plays a role, but you can watch all of that.
He cares about his demos.
Yes, indeed.
Apparently.
News breaking this morning. NBC says it has reached a deal with the Tonight Show host Conan O'Brien for his official exit from the show. Big surprise. Allowing Jay Leno to return to the late night program he hosted for 17 years. And all this morning, we're still talking with you about the Democrats' loss in Massachusetts. We've been hearing for months that Obama needs 60 votes in the Senate. Senate to get health care reform passed. So does not reaching that number prevent Congress from making big changes? What does David say? He writes us, the 60-vote rule in the Senate should be changed, but not because it makes health care difficult now, because it gives individual senators too much power. Lewis emails, they should keep the 60-vote rule, but the filibuster rule should go back to speaking for 24 hours. Congress makes everything too easy for themselves. What do you think? I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Miles O'Brien. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.